It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's population is aging. State estimates show almost a quarter of residents will be 65 or older by 2040. Helping people stay mobile as they age is critical to help maintain quality of life. But local public transit agencies and nonprofits are already struggling to do that. Jonah Chester reports.
It's a warm October day in Green Bay, and Kathy Koch has a dentist appointment to get to.
All right.
Just hold it right there, and I'll come on the other side.
Okay, sounds good.
Koch is 79 and has lived in the same home for more than half a century. She relies on a walker to get around, and she can't drive herself to the office.
My husband's been dead for a while, so to ask the children, it's difficult. They all work. The grandchildren all work.
Koch relies on an organization called Curative Connections. The Green Bay nonprofit provides services, including transportation, to the elderly and people with disabilities. As the driver helps her out of the van, she says Curative is also a connection to her community.
Oh, I love the human contact.
Yeah, it's very important.
It doesn't happen very often. I'm going to let you get the bell.
People over 65 are becoming a larger and larger portion of Wisconsin's population. That means more people will rely on specialized transportation to stay mobile. But without more support, Wisconsin's paratransit systems may not be ready to support the state's aging population. Like other states, Wisconsin received transportation funding through federal infrastructure and COVID aid bills. Green Bay Metro Transit Director Patty Kiewiz says that money was helpful, but wasn't a permanent fix.
So I think the next few years here will be, you know, in a much better position than we have been. But, you know, that's also something you need to be careful of, is that's really kind of one-time money. Then what are we going to do in a couple, you know, in 3 years?
That's a multi-million dollar question. The largest source of state funding to improve transit for the elderly and disabled hasn't risen in years. And other state transit spending fell to its lowest level in more than a decade last year. Green Bay Metro has coped with declining funds by cutting and consolidating bus routes and paratransit services. They're trying to fill the gaps with a local ride-hailing app. Organizations like Curative Connections are trying to patch the remaining cracks in the system, but they're also facing the economic challenges of inflation and higher gas prices. Curative's transportation director, Tina Wietung, says they've also lost about half of their volunteer drivers since the beginning of the pandemic, and they can't afford to replace all of them with paid drivers.
We've had to limit the number of rides based on volunteer and driver availability, so we're down probably 30% compared to prior years before COVID.
Advocates say on-demand services like Curative are important, but still imperfect. Tamara Jackson co-chairs the Non-Driver Advisory Committee for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. She says many paratransit resources are concentrated in urban areas.
Public transit often ends at jurisdictional boundaries. So a lot of times, even if there is public transit available, you know, it might end at the county line or the city line.
Even within those jurisdictions, there can be gaps.
Public transit simply isn't everywhere where people need to go.
Changing that would mean a significant shift in how local and state officials design their services. So what's the solution?
This is both a funding and a structural puzzle to solve.
Denise Jess is another co-chair of the Non-Driver Advisory Committee. Jess is also legally blind and a non-driver, so she's experienced many of the barriers she's trying to address.
My invitation is that the state legislature really comes to the table and works with us on this very complex transportation problem that we face in this state.
Governor Tony Evers and state legislators will have the chance to do that when work on the next state budget begins in February. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There is nothing like a French baguette, the perfectly golden crisp crust and its chewy, soft and fluffy inside. The United Nations has taken note, giving the French baguette World Heritage status as a tradition to be preserved by humanity. Join in with your questions about the baguette, your stories about French-style breads and bakeries, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jean Webb is owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie, with locations in Shorewood and Mequon in the suburbs of Milwaukee. Jean, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, you are a Paris-trained baker. What makes the French baguette a cultural icon?
You know, it's the combination. I mean, the theme in French baking is the kind of threading the needle of getting opposing qualities in the same product, and the discipline and skill it takes to do that. But right, and you mentioned it in your introduction, right? That crispy golden crust with that soft, fluffy crumb, the inside of the bread. That it's that contrast that's just lovely, and it just became at the turn of the century when baguettes became popular in France. It immediately took off. It supplanted what would had previously been the quote unquote national bread, which was a sourdough or miche boule. It was just phenomenal, and it struck a chord.
What does the UNESCO designation, what does that mean for the French baguette? What do you think it will do?
I think it's absolutely necessary. Modern France, present-day France, is under the same pressures, food industry pressures, that the rest of the developed world is in, which is the heavy, heavy industrialization of food and food production. And so it's, you know, it may be surprising and perhaps it's something that not out there in common knowledge, although it arises in articles here and there. There are many French villages now that don't actually have a bakery. These large industrial commissaries are pushing out bread similar to what we developed decades ago. That is very inexpensive to make. The ingredients are of sometimes questionable quality. Everything's mechanized. And so these artisan bakeries, who rely upon actual people to make the bread, which is an expensive way to do it, to use human labor to do it, are under an immense amount of pressure. So this designation, which is in many ways a treaty between the UN and the member country, not only does it allow the prestige of the UN to be, you know, shine a spotlight on something that the world agrees is a wonderful thing that we developed as in humanity, if people will allow me to be that bold about something that's food,
we'll allow.
Okay. But it also, on the other side of that treaty, it allows the French bakers to lobby their government and say that the UN has shown a light on this, and we would like to compete for these resources to safeguard this item. And so, right when every year, we're talking about the French baguette now. So when the French budgets are put together by their legislature, the baking lobby can say, hey, we need to move up in the priority list. We need a line in the budget to safeguard either the training of young bakers, the building and refurbishing of classic artisan bakeries, so that they can compete more effectively with these big industrialized producers.
Oh, wow. I mean, when you frame it like that, and that gives a little bit of insight there to the training and the art and the craft and the knowledge that goes into this type of bread. How do baguette ingredients compare to other breads?
Well, you know, baguettes are very, right, as you mentioned, very simple, four ingredients. What creates that nuance of flavor, of course, is what is the yeast culture that you use? How hot is the oven? Are you on a stone? The baguette gets its flavor, or almost all artisan French breads get their flavor from two directions: the yeast or microbes that are fermenting and creating those fermentation products, and how hot the oven can get the bread to create that crust, which then flavors the crumb. So it's the quality of the wheat and the flour, of course, is very important. We have, again, you know, the commercialization of food isn't just that finished product. Now it's the commercialization of production of the ingredients and in the the manipulation, the chemical manipulation of those ingredients, if you can get away from all that, which most all those manipulations have been put into place for the benefit of the producers and not the consumer, if you can get away from all those manipulations, which create often a product that looks about right, maybe has a flavor in the right direction, but in the end is really just a pale and, you know, it's sometimes often in bread, it's actually pale. It's a pale substitute. And if, you know, the baguette garnered like the support in society that it did, because it's just, it hits the palate just beautifully. That, like I said, the texture, the flavor is something that was lovely. And it's, you know, each French bread is different, right? The sourdough or miche has its qualities, which are wonderful too. But it's really allowing the training and the infrastructure to continue to exist so that this actual wonderful food can continue to exist in the world.
Jean Webb owns a French bakery in the North Shore suburbs of Milwaukee. As we talk about the baguette and its essential place in French identity, Colin, about the baguette, the cultural touchstone it is, or other pastries that you want recognized, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the craft knowledge and the art of making bread through the tradition and identity connected to the French baguette. An astounding 6 billion baguettes are sold in France every year. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We have bakery owner and head baker in the Milwaukee area. Jean Webb is our guide. Let's take a call now. Mike in De Pere is on the line. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yes, baguettes have been around forever, and I was wondering if baguettes were originally brown in color, since we use bleached flour now.
Great question, Mike. Thank you. Jean?
Yeah, you know, early on, before all of the chemical manipulation of flour began mid-century, baguettes were darker in color. A lot of that was not because there was, quote unquote, white flour. It wasn't bleached, but also agricultural practices in the 1800s and earlier meant that the wheat fields always had the seed stock that planted the wheat fields was always slightly mixed in with a little bit of rye. And so no field had exactly 100% wheat. There was always a little bit of rye in there. And so originally, yes, the color was darker because there was no bleaching agents, although they did air dry the flour, so it did lighten up, but also because there was a little bit of rye in there.
Oh, that's so interesting. Mike, thank you so much for that question. When you look at those four simple ingredients, what about the water? Can the water make a difference? I mean, we've talked with breweries before that say Lake Superior has the best quality of water for making better quality beer. Does that hold true for the baguette with water?
Oh, absolutely. Water quality, when you're working with just four ingredients, right, every one of those shines. There's not a huge complexity there. I think in Milwaukee, we're very lucky in that we have a non-chemical water treatment. It's an ionization purification system, which doesn't manipulate the water overly. So we're getting pretty good natural water. But yeah, you can, you know, in municipalities where, for example, in Chicago, where they have an older water purification system, and they will often, because of deficiencies in the system, will have to drop bleach into the water at different times of the year. And that has a really detrimental effect on your final product. It harms the yeast. It doesn't taste good. So you have to really be careful. A lot of bakeries have to have their own purification systems on site to remove some of those things.
have an email here from Buzz, wants to know if there is a standard dough weight for a baguette. Buzz loves making French baguettes, said it takes a lot of practice to get the right shape, but shoots for about 280 to 300 grams. What are your insights for Buzz?
So it depends on which context you're thinking. There have been long breads in France that, quote unquote, baguettes that were up to 6 to 9 feet long, believe it or not, a meter long. Today, if you were to enter an international baguette competition, they shoot for 270, the final weight. Your dough, for example, in our bakery and our baking practices, our wet dough going in is 350 grams. By the time it comes out of the oven, it's 270, and that's what I shoot for.
Okay. What is so particular about the weight, the actual weight of the bread? I mean, you see the images of the bread being weighed in France. Why is weight so important to the final product?
I think it's more of a cultural norm. You know, if you talk to chefs and bakers, most all of them agree that as bakers, we are very very anal retentive. We have to get a final baked product, you have to be fairly precise in weighing your ingredients going in, or else the structure and everything doesn't work out. And you can't adjust along the way, unlike in a lot of culinary disciplines, where you can adjust things as you're cooking. I think it's just cultural. We sit there. We have very precise scales for doing this, and it's one of the things that drew me to bread baking was this adherence to precision. And you can make, as I mentioned before, you can make a quote unquote baguette most any size, any length. It should be long, and there are international standards for it. The baguette in international competitions. But for example, we have chefs that we bake for here in Milwaukee who want an extra long baguette or an extra wide baguette, not quite a batard, but for their dining room service, they need a certain width. And so we can shape it to that width and bake it and deliver it to them.
Talking about French baguettes and baking with Gene Webb, a French-trained baker in the greater Milwaukee, business owner as well. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Linda emailed, wants to know, what does it mean when the French say that quality French bakery needs to be twice baked?
When it means twice baked, I guess it depends on the product.
I'm wondering, is it about the proofing or no, that twice baked? I'm not sure what's at the heart of the question, but you can talk a little bit about the baking process. What goes into it?
Well, you know, what allowed the development of kind of what we think of as a baguette today is the introduction of steam injection, or the ability, and it's one of the reasons that it's sometimes a little difficult to bake at home. The ability to put the shaped final proofed dough into the oven and have a steam around it, a wet cycle and then a dry cycle. The wet cycle allows the bread to expand and not form a crust yet. So you get oven spring, quote unquote, oven spring. It allows the inside to be kind of fluffy and open. And then you evacuate the oven in that you remove all the moisture and then you set the crust and set the browning. It's the transfer of heat from the stone, which is much more efficient than kind of transfer of heat from the air, and having the steam there and then be able to get the steam out of the oven. And I think the recipes that I provided, you know, give some hints as to how you can do that in your oven at home. But we use Bonguard French deck ovens for our baking, and that's all built into the oven.
Okay. And we're going to get into these recipes in just a bit. But generally, is it more difficult in a home kitchen compared to your setup in a professional bakery?
Oh yeah, I think that's very fair to say.
Okay.
We're set up for efficiency, so that we can do more. I mean, the one thing that is hard to do in a professional kitchen is to do small batches, right? Because all your equipment is large.
Mm.
But yeah, it's, you know, making sure you have, you know, as simple as having the rolling carts, being able to move it around, the mixers, which we can talk about, which is very important. Stronger mixers will mm-hmm. allow for easier development of the dough strength. Yeah, all the way around.
Let's pause there with Gene Webb, owner and head baker of two French bakeries in the Milwaukee suburbs. Join our conversation with questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the cherished French baguette and how to craft European pastries. Call in about French breads, desserts that transport you to Paris. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Gene Webb, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie, and stays with us. Let's take another call now. Jeff in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hi. So my question is about, like, when to visit a boulangerie. I'm assuming that a bunch of bread comes out of the oven in the morning, but is there, like, another shift of baking that gets done? So, you know, when would you suggest coming by to get the best bread?
Jeff, thank you so much. Gene?
You know, when your bakery's kind of operating on the classy schedule, first thing in the morning is the best time. And especially for a baguette, you know, the long shape where there's a high surface to volume ratio, they dry very quickly. They're not a bread with a very long shelf life. So first thing in the morning, a baguette shouldn't be eaten straight out of the oven. That's something you do with American style bread. French breads need to sit on a wire rack for an hour or 2 hours, but usually the baguettes are out of the oven at least that long, maybe 2 hours before the shop opens, and then the baguettes are ready to go. The crust is at its crispiest, all the flavor from that browning reaction on the surface has worked its way into the crumb. Excess moisture from the crumb has worked its way out, and the crust has recrisped itself. It happens quite naturally. And so in those first couple hours when the bakery's open, it's the best time to go get a baguette. Some bakeries, if they're large enough, and we're not a huge bakery, they can sometimes do a second round of baking, but by and large, we don't. There is sometimes people will re-crisp a baguette, and that's something you can do at home quite nicely.
Yes. But yeah, how would you suggest reviving a baguette that's gone a little hard?
Well, once it's hard, it's almost over.
Okay. the relationship is no good anymore.
Right. You've got croutons at that point,
okay,
or crostini. But if the baguette has gone a little soft, which depending on the time of year, right, in August, that often happens. If your hydration level is a little bit high, the excess moisture can come out and soften the crust again a couple hours later. Toss it into a hot oven. What I tell customers is that, you know, 400 degrees, 350, 400 degrees, and hold it in your oven until you start to see a little additional color coming on. If you see additional color coming on, pull it out. But then again, let it rest for an hour or so before you try to serve it.
Can we introduce the freezer here? Is there a best way to freeze dough or to preserve it for future baking?
The dough itself, no.
Okay.
The baked product. There are doughs that can be frozen. I've never tried to freeze baguette dough. I'm afraid that would, you know, the impact on the yeast would be too detrimental. The proofing and everything would probably be bad or not sufficient to get you what you want. But if you have a bag that's on the lighter side and you want to hang on to it, you know, wrap it up very tightly so that, you know, today we have frost-free freezers, which means they're pulling moisture out of the freezer cabinet and they'll pull moisture out of your whatever you put in it unless you wrap it up real well. And then you can hang on to it. Bread freezes quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring it out. Baguettes, you sometimes can go straight from freezer to oven because they're thin enough and small enough for the heat to penetrate. Larger shaped breads probably should bring to room temperature before you try to put them back in the oven.
Okay, good to know. My colleague Trina wrote in a really wonderful note, has been making baguettes almost every week since they went to France at the end of last year, making them using a gluten-free brown rice sourdough starter, psyllium husk, brown rice flour, potato starch, olive oil, and salt. And says, gotta have the baguette pan for ultimate crispness. Can you talk about adapting the traditional baguette for gluten-free or other sensitive diets?
Right. The set of adjustments that you just described would probably absolutely require the use of a baguette pan, those shaped pans that have their troughs that are perforated.
Mm-hmm.
But classically, baguettes, and that's because the recipe that you just described is probably on the weaker side. The dough doesn't have a lot of strength, so it needs a pan to provide its shape until it can be baked. Classically, baguettes are not done in pans like that. They're proofed on what's called couche, which is French for diaper. It's a cloth, a floured cloth. So it has to be able to hold itself up even during the proofing process. But it also, once it goes into the oven, it has to hold itself up. It goes the dough directly onto the stone without any support around it. So when you make those sort of adjustments and you do those sorts of things because the dough would be a little bit weaker and would require some support. But yeah, it's
possible.
It is possible. You just make further adjustments.
You mentioned mixers a little bit ago. What utensils or what is really helpful to have on hand when making baguettes?
I think one of the mixers, a mixer with a good strong motor, if you're going to do this frequently. A lot of the mixers today that are on the commercial market for home use have lighter weight motors because for most people, they're just doing batters and meringues, which don't take much power. So try to get a good quality mixer. If you can get a dough hook that is not rounded but is flat, that's helpful also. A flatter dough hook can actually grab the dough as it's mixing and stretch it, which is really what creates the strength. And you know, this is going to sound silly, but one of the most important things is once you have a baguette proof, you somehow have to get it into the oven, and you're working with basically this soft, delicate, really, really delicate noodle, large noodle, right? So you've got to be able to maneuver around the kitchen. So get a baguette flipper, or you can go to Home Depot and get a long flat board, and be able to move your baguette around that way. The most frustrating, I think, at home is when you've gone through this entire process and there you have this beautifully proofed baguette loaf that is
a work of art,
something longer than 20 inches long, and you have to stand there and figure out how you're going to get this unwieldy thing into the oven without destroying it. Even probably more important than the mixer is to have some way to get that baguette into the oven onto the stone.
My blood pressure is going up as you say that. We're talking about French baguettes and baking with Jean Webb, French-trained baker in the greater Milwaukee area, business owner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Can you describe the French sablé cookie and offer advice or even a quick recipe to make them to perfection?
Sablé cookies, yes. It's a sort of shortbread. We make a sablé every sablé stars. We just made a whole bunch of them for the holidays. If you look up on Amazon, a French pastry chef by the name of Jackie Pfeiffer. He's an Alsatian baker, so around Strasbourg, so that's why a Frenchman has a name like Pfeiffer. But he is one of the kind of world-known pastry chefs. And in his cookbook that he won a Beard Award for, actually, the cookbook that came out a couple of years back. It was before the pandemic. And he has just a wonderful sablé recipe in that book.
I think I like them dipped in chocolate, or, you know, you can make them in different ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a sablé dough is very, very versatile.
Uh-huh.
Ours, for example, we put cardamom in it, flavor it that way. But sablé dough is used for tart shells, for cookies. It's a type of consistency, sablé, the type of crumbling that it does, and the technique for getting the butter worked into it.
Mm, I need one right now with a cup of tea. I'd be good to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, speaking of recipes, you shared a couple. One was for a baguette, which I appreciate because it's day one and day two. Mm-hmm. And the baguette with Louvain. I think that means leaven. Is that right? The culture there?
Right. It's the yeast culture. Wild yeast culture.
Can you walk us a little bit through the day one and day two? Give us a sense of what's involved.
So, you know, day one will be familiar to anyone who does sourdough baking. Levain is sort of the French cousin, or our sourdough culture is the American cousin to the French Levain. Day one is you're just getting the culture up and active. Levain is, and as well as sourdough cultures, are these wonderful, wonderful self-balancing populations of about 30, at least 30 different microbes. 10 different yeast, the predominant one being Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is what we think of as bread yeast and brewer's yeast. And then at least 20 different bacteria. And so that culture needs to be fed. It's fed with flour. So you need to, it needs to be active. Often if, our grandparents and great grandparents, they often kept these growing and they were growing every day. For a home baker now who may not do it every day, you need to at least take a day to get your yeast culture up and growing and active.
And this is your bread and butter, because I want to step in and say you hold a doctorate in yeast genetics.
Surprisingly, as that happened, it wasn't a connection that I made until later in life. So yeah, absolutely. I find it remarkably interesting from multiple perspectives. But yeah, but the most interesting perspective is the flavor that comes out of these fermentation processes. That, you know, all those microbes working together, they balance out the population, and each one has a different role to play. Right, the bacteria that are in natural, we think of sour cultures or Levain cultures as yeast, but there's a lot of bacteria in there. They handle the really complex starches and mm-hmm. break it down, so that the yeast, who prefer simpler sugars, simpler starches, just like us, as our GI tract and as our physiology works, and they just do wonderful things. Mankind has, I mean, maybe the Levain should have UNESCO designation.
I knew that was coming.
I'm not sure who you'd give credit for. I mean, that there's folklore around that whole thing, but yeah, exactly. So yeah, day one, getting those microbes up and running, having them happy and growing at a good speed, and having the population all balanced, and then using that culture to leaven your baguette. Traditionally, early on. Although, I mean, today a lot of baguette recipes only use quick rise yeast and powdered yeast. But early on,
all bakeries used these Laban. Mm. When times get tough, I think we can still go back to that. I know, for example, when the pandemic hit, we were going, the supply chains were getting stretched and there was no yeast, no quick rise yeast, which is used in other products. And so we reworked our recipes so that we could use what we were growing in the shop to make sure we could keep the products running.
Wow. That's really interesting. Jean Webb runs two French-style bakeries in Milwaukee's North Shore suburbs. Call in with your questions about the craft of bread making or share what you've learned in the kitchen. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the heels of France's iconic long bread loaf, the baguette, achieving cultural heritage status, we explore the art of bread making. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Jean Webb is here, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie, with two locations in the Milwaukee suburbs. So, Jean, you know, how do you know you've got a good culture in day one of the recipe to take that sour culture into day two and be confident with it?
The easiest way is to, once you, on day one, as you're providing the culture with fresh water and fresh flour, you should start to see the culture expand. As the yeast and the bacteria grow and the yeast are producing CO2, you should see your culture within, I'd say, 2 hours or so. You should see it start growing. And actually, this is an excellent point. Whatever vessel you feed it in should be clean, without any soap or sterilization residue, because that'll harm the microbes. But it should also be big enough to allow the culture to expand so that you're not, your culture doesn't kind of overtop whatever jar you're putting it in. But yeah, within 2 to 3 hours, you should start seeing it rise up and grow and get bubbly.
Okay. I want to just jump in here with Tom in Dubuque, Iowa. Tom, hi, go ahead.
Hello, good morning. Pleasure listening to your show. I have both successfully and unsuccessfully baked bread before, but I wondered if you could give some recommendations on coming up with your own sourdough starter, and how best to feed that, and when, how long it can be stored in the refrigerator before use. Thank you.
Excellent questions. It's very satisfying to start your own sourdough culture, but you have to be very, very patient. As I mentioned before, it's a self balancing population of up to 30, maybe 40 microbes, depending on where you're at in the country. So when you first start, basically, if you just take a vessel with flour and water, it's a half flour, half water. That's considered by baker percentages to be 100% hydration. Microbes in the air will seed that flour and water mixture. But because the bacteria tend to grow much faster, they're much simpler and will initially outcompete any yeast that fall in there. Your culture will be quite frightening for about the first 2 weeks. It will smell terrible because bacteria don't really smell good to us. But persevere and don't run. In time, sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks, the yeast will start to get a foothold. And then the population will balance out. You can help yourself a couple of ways to maybe help this process along a little bit faster. You can drop dried fruit or fresh fruit, organic, unwashed fruit into the culture, and sometimes a little bit of malt syrup, because the yeast like the simple sugars, whereas the bacteria like the more complex starches. And so how the fruit helps is that if you've ever been out in the orchard and you picked an apple and you look at it and it looks cloudy and you think it's just dust or dirt or schmutz, And you polish it on your shirt and eat the apple. That film, most of it is actually wild yeast. So if you can get an organic fruit that has not been washed and drop it in, you're actually inoculating the culture with these wonderful wild yeast. So you can help the process along, but really it's be brave, persevere. And in time, it may take a couple of weeks, but that culture will balance itself out. That does mean that initially every couple of days, you're going to start with a fresh vessel with flour and water, 50-50, and then add a little bit of the previous culture. It's important to keep feeding it fresh, but it will, as I said, in a couple of weeks, give you a beautiful Lavan or sourdough culture that is quite specific to your region, the terroir of that of your area, and will give you a wonderful bread.
Tom, does that help?
It does very much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. We only have a few moments left, but I just want to acknowledge the other recipe you sent along our way. Find them at wpr.org/mornings. But the French country white bread with fermented dough. Any highlights you can share about this recipe?
The fermented dough is probably the first way that bakers leaven bread. Yeah, and it's a pre-ferment like Lavan or sourdough. But it allows you to get started right away. You don't have an ongoing culture. You use dry yeast, make some dough, let it ferment, let the yeast grow, chill it, and then you use that chilled dough the next day to start in. And in those 24 to 48 hours, the solo kind of monoculture of S. cerevisiae will be able to undertake enough fermentation to provide you with a beautiful, beautiful flavor.
Okay, so would you consider that to be a bit of a gateway bread to bake to try out if you haven't been baking much before?
Right, absolutely, because it's the shape is it's a batard, so it can fit in your hand. It's not so intimidating to move around the kitchen. It's a tight crumb bread with a nice French crust, but not the really aggressive crust that you usually want in a baguette. So yeah, I think it is. I think it would be a wonderful gateway drug.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Gene Webb is owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie. We have a link to the baguette. We have a link to the French country white bread recipes. They're on our program page, wpr.org/mornings, to check them out. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Ha ha ha.